Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Hey, that's me. And I'm sitting at the intersection where common sense and economic sense meet to make green sense. Bob Kessler, executive producer, will tell us more about who we're going to meet this week.
Major League Baseball has been doing a lot in the way of sustainability, so we'll have someone from the big leagues telling us about that, and our good friend Tom Appel will be looking at peak cars, peak oils, and the possible decline of the Prius.
Well, let's play ball on Green Sense. The crack of the bat, the cheer of the crowd, the smell of hot dogs and beer. Is there anything more summer and more American? And we must not forget the splendid green grass in the outfield. But as it turns out, that's not the only green thing when it comes to Major League Baseball. We're joined now by Paul Hanlon, Senior Director for Ballpark Operations and Sustainability for Major League Baseball. Paul, welcome to Green Sense.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Major League Baseball is made up of 30 teams, and they're all run by different owners and organizations that are quite different. Sounds a lot like the electric grid here in the U.S. Was it challenging to get them all on board with sustainability?
You know, it's actually something that the clubs came to us with. And, you know, and it's really, you know, it's helpful to realize it's not one size fits all when it comes to this. And, you know, everybody contributes in, you know, in different ways. And it actually kind of made my job quite easy because people wanted to be a part of this. And so a lot of, you know, what the clubs will do with each other is best practice sharing, like what might work in that particular market. It was probably about 10 years ago that they said, hey, we want to participate in this space. And how do we do that? And it's been great seeing the growth of it the last several years. And we issue a press release on Earth Day every year. You know, sounds simple, but it's one of the only things we do that includes stories from all 30 clubs. So it's something that everybody's been committed to, and it's been really exciting for us.
Well, change doesn't happen without a champion. Was there one ball club that really spearheaded this, or was there a small coalition?
Yeah. So in the beginning, the first few clubs that came together, this is 2008 when everything kind of began, and the San Francisco Giants, the New York Yankees, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Seattle Mariners, you know, a few of our stadium operators who run the ballparks got together and said, let's make something happen. And, you know, kind of the beginnings of that started the movement at baseball, but it also started it with the Green Sports Alliance, which is a group that's made up of all the leagues and the teams across the board. And, you had a few champions in different parts of the industry and come together and kind of push everything forward and get, you know, help to get everybody else on board.
2008 was right at the beginning of the Great Recession. Did that have any correlation to sustainability, which not only improves the environment, but it saves on the bottom line?
I wasn't there when everything started, but I think your point's a good one. You know, this makes business sense as much as anything for everyone. And so when this when this started, you know, part of it was okay, like we'll make this initial commitment to save energy, save water, and then, you know, on the flip side, it makes, you know, business sense as well to start these practices. So I would assume that went into the thinking at the time.
As we were talking or alluding to it earlier, sustainability programs can be infectious and they can be fun. So let's talk about some sustainable innovations coming to some of the ballparks next season that maybe we haven't talked about or heard of.
So, you know, a lot of what's been happening the last few years has been, it's been around energy. It's been around the elimination of single use plastics when things, in certain instances. So, you know, every year kind of a few clubs will take a run at making a change and then other clubs will follow. So I would anticipate, for next season, more gardens. Like, for example, like a lot of folks don't know that 12 of our ballparks have on-site gardens. And, you know, and I don't know definitely which clubs will be doing more in that sense next year, but, you know, I've had a lot that have come to me and said, okay, well, what are they doing in Boston with this garden that they have on the roof at Fenway Park? Or what are they doing in San Francisco with a locally sourced garden in the outfield area where they actually have a concession stand attached to it? And they're selling, vegetables that they've grown right there. So, you know, I think the garden trend will continue. I think the, addition of LED lighting in the building and replacement in certain areas, the food donation programs that a lot of these clubs are doing. So, you know, it's a lot of kind of initial ideas that have grown the last few years that, you know, every year a few clubs will take one of those ideas and really truly run with it.
The bottom line for all these teams is to get to the World Series. But yep. It's all about the fans. You've got to please the fans. Are there any programs that involve the fans? Sustainability ideas that are fun and engaging?
Yeah. So our green teams, which we feature at our All-Star Games and our World Series, are also programs that are featured during the season by several of our clubs. And really, it's a group that will go through the stands and collect recyclables. And in a lot of instances, I don't think we anticipated the fan engagement piece of that being as prevalent as it was, because fans ask questions. The program that we do at the All-Star Game is also tied into a college course around the greening of a sporting event. So not only do you have these college students learning about what goes into greening a major sporting event, but they're out there and they're interacting with the fans, and the fans are like, okay, wait, so what do I put in this and how do I do this? And with the long-term goal for me, and something as a league we've always strived for, is, okay, if this can be done at the ballpark every night and we're, you know, going out and trying to figure out, okay, what goes in a compost bin, what goes in a recycling bin, I want those same thoughts to go on when they're home, you know, and you're trying to figure out what to do at home. And if we can, engage those folks every night, 81 times a year, 35,000 people in some cases, I think that fan engagement is, you want to participate in all aspects of your life. And so I think that's a way that we tie that in.
Well, sports players have always been looked at as heroes and role models. So yeah. That'd be great for them to be a green role model.
Absolutely. We had Brent Suter, who's a pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, on Earth Day, actually came around with us and did a lot of appearances on different radio stations, TV stations, promoting this. And during spring training, he went out and bought reusable water bottles for all of his teammates. And he said, okay, this is what we're doing in the clubhouse. We're getting rid of plastic water bottles. You're going to have, you're going to have these reusable bottles. And he's raising awareness, and he came to us and he said, look, I want to help magnify this message. And it's been great, working with him on that and seeing how that's grown. And then, encouraging more, athletes to do the same. And fans, fans love that.
You'll have to give them green stars on their uniforms when they become a green role models.
Absolutely. That's awesome.
Earlier this year, the New York Yankees became the first major North American sports team to join the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework. What does that mean for the team, and are others following suit?
So the Yankees have always been leaders in so many things, but in this space as well. And when the framework was announced, they made the decision, we want to be leaders in this. And it really, it's commitments for the organization, for Yankee Stadium, to really, continue to improve their practices when it comes to these environmental efforts. And so obviously it's a standard for themselves, to hold themselves to over time. But it's also something that they're hoping, and we're hoping as well that other clubs follow. And so, we've gotten a lot of questions from other teams, like, okay, what are the Yankees doing in this space? How can we join? And so, I anticipate, as with so many things that we're doing, where one team kind of is that leader, that other clubs will start to follow. And so, we're excited about that. We're excited for the Yankees and for us to have a seat at the table as, different types of ideas are developed for stadiums all across the world.
Baseball is such a powerful marketing tool to really promote such green ideas. And the San Francisco Giants last year won the Green Glove Award by recycling 94% of the waste at Oracle Park.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Are you finding other teams are now trying to outdo each other for the Green Glove Award?
Absolutely. You know, we've
they're all competitive, right?
You know, it's funny, and that's the thing. You wanna play off of that competitive nature, and it's a good natured competitiveness when it comes to this, and it's fun for us. You know, this began, I think, 11 years ago. We have a yearly operations conference that we run with all of the 30 clubs, and you know, and they, you know, we're really looking at like the data and like, okay, how, you know, which clubs are doing it really is a motivating tool. And, you know, the Giants won the first one 11 years ago and then consecutively won it for 9 years. Last year, so the Giants won again last year, but in 2017, the Mariners all of a sudden came out of nowhere and dethroned the Giants. And, it was really that, again, that competitiveness. And it's been fun watching the clubs go back, you know, because go back and forth on it. And, you know, actually, we were at a conference and a team president for one of the clubs, you know, we mentioned this Green Glove Award and talked about the 94% with the Giants. And he looked out in the crowd and he saw his employees and he said, "We're going to beat them." He's like, "We want that Green Glove Award." And that was fun. You know, it was fun to. And it's become an exciting thing for all of the clubs, and it's become an exciting thing for fans that are interested in this, and just another way that teams can compete with each other.
Are you finding any spillover to professional football, basketball, hockey?
Yeah, you know, all of the other leagues are very, very active in this space. You know, I mentioned the Green Sports Alliance earlier, and you know, and so we're, you know, I think it's the same thing, right? I think we're all competitive with each other. You know, in a variety of issues. And this is something that, you know, we regularly meet via the Green Sports Alliance to talk through what's being done in each of our leagues. And you know, I have a counterpart at each of those different places, and we're constantly talking. And the Green Sports Alliance has been a great vehicle for all of us to come together and push the industry forward. So yeah, it's exciting what's going on in all the other sports as well.
Well, there's a long list of green accomplishments among the teams. As you mentioned earlier, many ballparks are having gardens to grow some of the concession foods. Yeah. A few teams have eliminated plastic straws to cut down on waste. 10 ballparks are using solar power. Teams like Arizona are using state-of-the-art artificial turf to cut down on water. Yeah. These are all great accomplishments, but no matter how good you are, there's always room for improvement. So what are areas in the league that you think really need to improve when it comes to sustainability?
You know, I think we can take more of a look at what we're doing with water. I think water is kind of the next piece of it. You know, the Twins have an amazing system with their partner Pentair, and where, you know, water is actually being, you know, they're capturing rainwater and you know, other water used in the building, and you know, and working with it to, you know, use that water to you know, clean the stands or water the grass. And, you know, and that's been a great thing. And along those lines, to see more partnerships with other companies and outside entities, I think that they're setting a standard when it comes to that. And I would love to see more clubs, you know, emulate that. You know, we started last year, or 2 years ago, we started working with Arizona State on ideas to improve in the Cactus League in spring training. And so I think, you know, with our major league clubs, so many of them off and running with these different initiatives, I would love to see, you know, our spring training venues in both Florida and Arizona start to, you know, really turn up the volume on that. So we'll work with those different clubs to see what can be accomplished in those spaces. We already got a really good head start with Arizona, and just, you know, raising general awareness, right? You know, I think we're in a really good point where we can truly tell the story now and hopefully inspire others to, again, like I said earlier, just, you know, be conscious at home, like what you're doing. And we've really done our job. My dad walks over to the counter at home and he's like, "Hey, what do I do with this, you know, takeout container? What do I do with it?" And you know, right, like what you're supposed to be doing with, you know, with these items. And I think I think that we've all done our job if we can inspire. So
in closing, in a sentence, tell me what you like best about your job and how you feel you've made such a big impact.
Oh, it is, it's a new challenge every day, but it's a fun one. And that's been, you know, every day for me is different, and working with all 30 clubs is the best thing that anybody could ask for. So
that's Paul Hanlon, Senior Director for Ballpark Operations and Sustainability for Major League Baseball, talking about greening up the league. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Tom, welcome to GreenSense.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, there's a number of trends happening out there that are changing mobility, how we move around in space. And, you know, we've covered these trends in transportation over the last several years as we've had you on the show. And I think we've predicted that a lot of these things may happen, but we're now starting to see them come forth. I want to pat you on the back since we've been forecasting these events in bits and pieces over the years, and now we see they are becoming reality. So one trend I've observed out there is peak oil.
Yeah, we have essentially decided economically that the world has consumed as much oil as we're going to consume, and that from now on, oil demand is going to be slipping slowly.
And maybe it's just a change in a life cycle of the use of oil. And I recently heard another term, peak car. Have you heard that term?
Yeah, and it's the same thing applied to the automobile. And if you're a car guy like me, there's a small tear in your eye about this, but it's a very interesting phenomenon economically and sociologically.
And I think that peak car, you know, the same a theoretical point where we've may have hit the maximum rate of production. We've had four record-breaking years of sales, but now I think we're hitting steady decline. And in my opinion, it's being created by all these mobility options. Electric scooters, you know, many cities have these scooters. You may love them or hate them, but they're around and they do change the way we move. We hear about robot taxis, all these rideshare apps and Uber and Lyft, and the forthcoming of autonomous cars. And also in part, and I think this is a big part, we have most of our population lives in urban areas, and people are just finding that it's too expensive to own and operate cars in urban settings. And so they're looking to all these options. What are your thoughts, Tom?
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the most interesting phenomenons to take place in the last 5 to 10 years is mobility and ride hailing services. When we've run into a situation where entry level wages have been stagnant, prices have gone up, and young people are looking for ways to not buy cars. And now there's Uber and Lyft and other ride hailing services that have replaced car ownerships in many ways. And if you can just take a ride for $8 to $12 instead of paying $600 a month for insurance and fuel and car payments, that is an option you're absolutely going to consider. And entry-level buyers are not getting into the car market, and that is absolutely in support of the fact that we have hit peak auto production. There just aren't that many new young buyers entering the market.
Do you think these two trends are related? You know, the decline of oil and the decline of car purchasing?
Yeah, they really are. There's a lot of things driving the oil thing as well, and that's that the fleet has just become more fuel efficient. Even though people have been moving to crossovers, a thing that has happened, and that has slowed the improvement in fuel economy, there are other things happening. And one of them is that it seems that China, on a global scale now we're talking, demand for cars in China has finally softened, and in fact may be contracting. And that was sort of the last great big market. It doesn't look like there's going to be that sort of surge in India. And while there may be one in Africa, it is probably going to be tempered by a reduction in sales in Western Europe, in Asia, and in North America.
Everything I read about China, is that they're also putting a big push on electric cars. So not only is there a decline maybe in demand, but the type of vehicle's changing and it's not using oil and gas anymore. Is that what you're saying too?
Yeah, that's interesting. China actually rewards both car buyers and the seller of vehicles with something it calls its New Energy Vehicle Program. And you are awarded points that you require or you will be heavily taxed or fined for not selling the appropriate number of green vehicles. And the NEV, New Energy Vehicle Standards, have changed in recent years, and they continually reward more and more electric vehicles. Standard hybrids, a vehicle like, say, the Toyota Prius, no longer qualify for NEV credits. So, yes, this movement is to purely electric vehicles.
Well, if you had one tear on your cheek, this may add another, and it's the decline of the Prius. And we've driven and talked about the virtues of the Prius for more than 7 years. And I've always thought the Prius is the gold standard for hybrids, but now interest in sales are declining. Tell me why, Tom.
Yeah, the Prius thing is really interesting. Prius sales in the U.S. peaked between 2010 and 2013 when they hit about 150,000 units a year. And we're talking about just the regular Prius. For a while, there was the Prius C, which was a subcompact, and the V, which is sort of a mid-sized family hatchback. But the sales have declined. And I've got a couple of theories about what's going on here, and we sort of just discussed some of them. But the Prius was redesigned a few years ago, and the redesign was considered somewhat controversial. Gas prices have been very stable in the U.S., so there's probably less demand for hybrid vehicles. But there's also a lot of competition now for the Prius from vehicles in Toyota's own lineup and from Kia, for example, and Hyundai. And then finally, the market is moving away from sedans, and the Prius is very much like a sedan, though it has a hatchback. It is a car, and Americans just don't really like cars anymore. They like crossovers.
Interesting. But when we look at these trends of peak oil and peak car, and I look at the cost of owning a car in a city, a Prius is relatively cheap, and it gets such great gas mileage, and it's small and mobile. I was a little surprised that sales were waning, and that this seems to be on the downside of the bell curve of sales.
Yeah, it's an interesting decline, and I think that one of the things, most important things that's happening is that Toyota's own showroom is working against the Prius. There is now the Corolla Hybrid. There is the Camry hybrid. There is the RAV4 hybrid. And I think a lot of the fuel economy of those vehicles is relatively competitive with the Prius. So if you no longer want a four-door hatchback sedan, which is kind of a weird body style anyway, you have alternatives. Additionally, the Prius was always sort of built specifically for fuel economy, and measures taken to make the vehicle a little bit lighter have resulted in a car that is slightly noisier and not as well finished inside as the other Toyota products. So I can very well see how someone who went to a Toyota dealership, thought about buying a Prius, was suddenly swayed into one of these other cars that might be a little sportier, a little bit more nicely finished, and not a lot more expensive.
So, Tom, connect the dots. You're the guru of gear. We got decline of oil, decline of cars, and one of the gold standard hybrids changing and losing interest. What is this doing to mobility and transportation? Or what does this indicate as far as it goes to mobility and transportation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it looks like we may have hit peak sales specifically in the U.S. At about 17.4 million units. And it's looking like this year we're not going to hit 17. So a relatively significant decline, and we are moving into what economists believe is a recession. So car sales are not going to go up next year either. In terms of the future of mobility, I think that we are on the cusp of seeing some sort of driverless breakthrough in some ride-hailing service that will probably lock this down and really reduce sales in limited markets. I think we're going to see it in places like California or out west first, but it is the beginning of the beginning of the end. I think this is going to be a very slow process. It's going to be interesting to watch. I think the car is far from dead, but fewer cars in a few years, absolutely.
So you might have two tears on one cheek, but a smile on part of your lips, because change always brings opportunities. And as you said, I think we are on the cusp of change. And we've talked about this on the show. Maybe we don't own cars anymore. Maybe the auto manufacturers are going to own all the cars, and we're going to use it'll be an a la carte transformation where we pay as we need.
Yeah, and that's part of a very broad conversation that I've been taking part of with my peers in the business. And that is a change in the way cars are branded. If, in fact, cars are autonomous and we no longer are that concerned about the visceral effects of driving or even just the quality of the interior of the vehicle, if we are ride-sharing or if we're just getting into someone else's autonomous vehicle, do brands matter? Do we care if there's a Chevy or a Buick or a Nissan? We may not. So the whole landscape of what is the auto industry and really what is mobility is going to change.
But it's exciting times, so I'll look forward to the future. Any closing remarks or thoughts on these two megatrends colliding?
Yes, on the way down. that sounds so depressing, but it's not. Electric vehicles are all sorts of fun to drive, so we do have some fun stuff to look forward to before the car entirely disappears. I just spent a week in the Nissan Leaf Plus, which is absolutely a joy to drive, and the range was phenomenal. So we have that to look forward to.
Tom, I know it's hard to prognosticate into the future, but at one point when we do have mass autonomous cars, do you think people will still be able to drive cars on their own, or will that be a paid luxury for them to do that?
That's a good question, and what's happening now in Europe may lend some sort of peek into the future where there are markets, specifically cities, where you're not allowed to drive a gasoline vehicle. And it is entirely possible that to drive a gasoline vehicle or a vehicle that you own yourself may require different licensing. That remains to be seen. But yes, it may at some point be more difficult, although this is decades away, more difficult or to license and own a vehicle that you are actually able to operate yourself versus one that is deemed safer because the system is taking care of a navigation.
That's Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive with Green Automotive News. Check out his articles and reviews at consumerguide.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of GreenSense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.